This is Audible.
The Regent's Shadow, written by Chris Raitt, narrated by John Banks, Emma Gregory, and Penelope Rawlings.
Chapter 1. Jack. He was gone. He had disappeared back into the void almost as soon as he'd arrived. And yet everything was still, one way or another, all about him. Some souls leave an indelible trace. I believe he was incapable of moving through the universe without profoundly changing it. In a sense, he was not even part of it. He had a body. He could be wounded. He breathed air and drank water. And yet you could not look into those eyes for long without seeing the overwhelming strangeness there. The quality of another place, bound up for a time in flesh and blood, but surely beyond it. I'd seen him only a handful of times, mostly from a distance. The first occasion was when I travelled with my then-master, Tyrone, to Luna, and witnessed the aftermath of the battle he and his warriors fought under hard starlight. I was not brave enough to accompany my master into Gilliman's presence, and so only observed that first meeting from afar. After that, we were separated, and Tyrone and I did not speak again until we were both back on Terra. And after that, the demons came, and it is difficult to recall anything without flinching. I was sick for a long time then. We all were, I think. The air was polluted with stronger poisons than we had ever known, and we were used to poisons on Terra. The stone beneath our feet felt fragile. When you put a finger out to touch something, a cup, a scroll, electricity would snap across the gap. A flicker of bloody energy that had no place on this or any other world. Amid it all, though, he was there. His energy was infinite. He fought the creatures that dared charge our walls, casting down the greatest of them. Even as the spires still burned, he spearheaded the assault that freed the Forlì's Gate and reforged the throne world's access to the Imperium. Warriors flocked to his side, given renewed purpose by the smallest of his actions, or even the rumours of them. When he returned to the palace, the pace of his reordering was frenetic. He had been used to torpor for so long, and now we had one among us who would tolerate no hesitation. None of us could look him in the eye and say no, save perhaps Valoris himself. Reforms were put in place that I had not expected to see enacted in my children's lifetimes, let alone mine. I never worked harder. Tyrone was gone by then, exhausted by his long service and the rigours of the cataclysm, leaving me to take his place. We were a study in contrasts, I suppose. He was old, indulgent, a product of insecurity. I was a relatively young woman, and in other times might have expected to serve for several decades more before taking the chain of office. I'd always had my eye on the position, and knew that I deserved it. But now the prize had been handed over into hands that felt, in truth, not quite ready. I'd been part of the palace machine for many years, of course, but even so, it was hard to grapple with everything that had to be done. The orders came in flurries, brought to my chamber by panicked attendants, and I had to somehow make sense of them and see them dealt with. I remarked on the difficulties to Mordecai, my adjutant. We were in my personal chambers, speaking in private conference. My inner room was a small space, sparsely furnished. I'd only just got rid of Tyrone's clutter, replacing it with the things I valued more greatly than vases and paintings. Cogitator terminals, advanced sensor arrays, secure comm links to the various agents we had in the field. The result was a strange mix of the ornate and the functional. It was in a state of improvised change, as were all things at that time. Mordecai did not offer an opinion. He was by then nearly 200 years old and steeped in the ancient rituals of the only place he had ever known. I also think he was in a state of shock and had taken to shuffling through the gilt corridors with his eyes half closed, shutting out the evidence that it was all ending. So many of my servants were like that, still rocked by all they had seen and experienced. Terra is a world built on tradition, much of it thousands of years old. We had come to depend on that, to make it a kind of religion to go alongside the official one, and having that foundation shaken had hurt us, I think, more than any of the physical damage that had been done. But just then, some weeks after the victory at Vorlees, while those we had recovered from the void were still confined to their medical stations, the summons came. I remember looking at the parchment docket in my hand, seeing the seal of office at the top of it, and the thin line of gold around the edge. A hollow ident glimmered faintly across the left-hand margin, which gave surety of its origin, though that felt superfluous, for none would have dared to forge a document with his name on it. I was daunted, I will admit it. I had grown up with the powerful and did not scare easily, but he was different. I went straight away. I left Mordecai hunched in front of all the stacked picked feeds and hurried to my personal living quarters. Much against habit, I checked my appearance carefully. Would I look ludicrous to him, being so new in position, largely untried, a possible weak link in the new chain of command he was building? It was possible that he had summoned me only in order to dismiss me, as he had done with so many of the high-ranking palace officials already. To be cast out of office that quickly would, I concede, have dented my pride, and I found myself rehearsing arguments as I went, hoping I would be sufficiently self-assured in his presence to deliver them. He had taken up residence in one of the older sectors of the Senatorum. These quarters were sufficiently close that I was able to walk to meet him, passing through a tangle of internal corridors, none of which had external windows. As I went, I passed that same mix of ancient and modern. Priceless gold statues leaning next to coils of Mechanicus cabling, fine carpets rolled up to reveal glittering machine pits beneath. Adepts and magi bustled around, prodding and fixing, restoring and meddling. We were all having to be seen to be busy, to be committed to the great restoration, knowing that the eye of the regent was on all things, and that even the smallest detail might be brought to his attention. Such were the dimensions of the inner palace buildings that, despite making use of several self-propelled walkways and privileged cut-throughs, it took me some time to reach his location. The chambers he had co-opted must have been more or less as they were when he had first dwelt here eons ago. The lack of change may have been reassuring to him. He had brought his space marines to guard him, which again was something that would not have happened here before. As I finally reached the great vaulted antechamber, replete with mosaic depictions of the nine primarchs fighting the old wars of myth, I found it uncomfortable to see them standing before the marble doors, perfectly still, perfectly silent, their faces hidden behind gold-winged masks. They had, I knew, travelled across the length of the entire galaxy to be here. Their armour, fine as it was, still bore the chips and scores of combat. I wondered what they thought of this place, now they were here, but of course did not ask them. As far as I was concerned, they were like golems, capable of being summoned to life through blood or spells, but in the meantime only made of inert matter. Nothing they did as I passed them by challenged that mental image. He did not only surround himself with soldiers. The chambers beyond were thronged with civilian servants, most in the blue-lined robes of Ultramar, some in Terran regalia. A number of those were either under my command or were otherwise known to me, but they did not attempt to catch my eye as I walked through their midst. Above them all, crystal chandeliers glistered. Below their slippered feet, the rugs were finely woven and of intricate design. The impassive faces of heroes gazed out across the throngs from oil paintings and frescoes. The murmur of conversation was just as it had always been in such places. Low, urgent, conspiratorial. I caught the eye of his duty officer, who immediately worked her way to my side. She was of ultramar, as were so many of those he trusted to be close to him.
"Chancellor," she said, bowing. "Thank you for coming so quickly. He awaits within."
I was led through the crowds and shown into his private chamber. Great gold-crusted doors closed behind me, sealing off all the chatter. I found myself in a high-ceilinged room. Cold grey light shone through tall external windows. The place smelled vaguely, I thought, of boot polish. The objects within were, I assumed, those that had been there for centuries. Antique desks and chairs and ornamental pillars. Incongruously, a large collection of chronometers had been placed in a cabinet behind armour glass. An obsidian figurine of Sanguinius stood in the corner. The duty officer had withdrawn, meaning that I was alone in there. Aside from him, of course. He looked up as I entered and rose from the heavy desk he had been working at. His size was not the most striking thing about him, although, of course, that was hard to ignore. He fixed me with that solid gaze of his, the one I had been warned about. When he looked at you, nothing tangible in his expression gave away that he was judging you. There was no overt criticism there, but still, somehow, you felt guilty, as if your sins had been uncovered all at once, and you were left scrambling to make excuses for them. I am sure, absolutely sure, that he did not intend that, for when he spoke, his voice was rather quiet, even solicitous, but there was no getting away from what he was, and what he had seen and done. Against that record, it was impossible, I suppose, to feel anything other than inadequate.
"Cancellarius,"
he said, using the more formal version of my title.
"My Lord Gilliman," I replied, bowing. "You wished to see me?"
He smiled, a brief, snatched gesture. His face was handsome in a patrician kind of way, though held rigid and scarred in the military manner. I knew how old he was, at least in absolute terms, though he wore the years lightly. He looked almost familiar, which made me think that the Ministerium image-makers must have used accurate models for their statues, the ones that had been distributed across all human worlds over the millennia, carved to standard dimensions and used to encourage devotion from the masses.
"I wished to see you weeks ago,"
he said, gesturing towards two low chairs that had been placed closer to the windows.
"It is the courtesies that slip when time is short. I'm sorry for that."
I sat opposite him. Ahead of us was the view of the world outside, the smouldering blackened spires stretching away under a grey sky.
"There is nothing to apologise for, my lord," I said.
In the strict run of things, he had no authority over me. He had no official rank at all within the Adeptus Terror. He was something we had no category for, and at that point he had not assumed the formal title of Imperial Regent, nor had he revived the old position of Lord Commander that he had occupied all those thousands of years ago. According to the Lex, I was under no obligation to speak to him at all. But all of us knew how things stood. If he had asked us to fall on our swords, we would have done it.
"You are the doorkeeper,"
he said.
"The High Council operates only because you facilitated. For what it's worth, you should know your predecessors spoke highly of you."
Ah, Tyrion. For all his human weaknesses, his little vices and indulgences, he was not a bad man.
I will be making changes,
Gilliman went on. He placed his hands together in front of him, angling the fingers.
There will be no bloodshed, no humiliation, but the council will answer to me from now on, and I cannot trust all its current members to do that.
I nodded. We had known that something of this nature would have to take place. Lord Frank, the master of the Astronomicon, had died during the first wave of anarchy to overtake the throne world, so he at least was due to be replaced. In the normal run of things, the succession would have taken place swiftly, but these were not ordinary times. The Forbidden Fortress, Frank's domain, was still under formal reconstruction following its near destruction when the rift had reached us, and it was not yet clear who would occupy it, nor what they would discover when they did.
"Do you have particular changes in mind?" I asked.
Of course he did. Gilliman reached down for a scroll on the table between us and handed it to me. I opened it and read five names, including Frank's, together with replacements. None were surprises. If I had been asked to draw up the list, I would have made many of the same judgments.
Is there anything there you would counsel against?
He asked. It was nice of him to ask.
They are excellent choices, my lord, I said.
I will speak to those affected in person,
he said.
But I wish to consult you first.
I appreciate that, my lord.
There is pressure from some quarters to change everything,
Gilliman said.
To sweep it all away. I have no intention of doing so. We are in a precarious strategic position, and I cannot undermine that which remains capable of functioning.
I rolled the parchment up again.
May I ask what timetable you envisage?
Within the week. And after that, reform of the subsidiary bodies.
He smiled again.
Do not fear, Cancellarius. Your position is safe. I place considerable faith in you. I hope that will be justified.
As he wills it, I said. But a week? It will be difficult to...
It cannot be delayed. Nothing can be delayed.
He leaned forward, and in that gesture I was reminded of his physical bulk, his sheer otherworldliness, the truth that he was only human at all in the loosest sense, and the trappings of domesticity, chairs, armour, parchment, were just props around him to enable us to comprehend it all.
I will not be on Terra long. I cannot be. Most of my time here has already been spent preparing the new crusade, the one that must depart before the year's end. These things, these appointments and reforms, they are the least of my worries. And when I am gone, you must maintain them.
So, that was the real purpose of this meeting. He was warning me of the coming rupture, knowing that it would be severe. We had only just come to terms with the idea that we might survive these times of trial, and that fragile hope was largely bound up in his presence among us. Take that away, and it would be harder not to remember how weak we really were. I was not capable of hiding those thoughts from him. He must surely have been expecting them.
Terra is still in profound turmoil, my lord, I said. Control does not extend far beyond these walls. If you depart before... He closed his eyes, and I stopped talking. For a moment, I perceived an enormous weariness in him, a mortal response to the infinite demands and hopes heaped upon his armored shoulders. I look back now and guess that every meeting he ever had ended the same way, with someone pleading for more help, more guidance, more protection.
The Imperium burns,
he said, quietly but firmly.
Every hour I spend here, behind my father's walls, is another hour when worlds are lost. My decision is made. It is correct. I ask only that you preserve what has been done here once I am gone.
I bowed. my cheeks flushing a little.
"It shall be as you command, my lord," I said.
And in what followed, I did what I could to make good on that promise. I understood the reasons. I respected the integrity of the decision. But I do not know if he was right. A Primarch is a godlike creature, a master of forces far beyond any we can hope to understand. But even the Church never taught that they were infallible. Those of us privileged enough to know a little history understood that they could make mistakes, and the mistakes of gods are greater than the mistakes of mortals. Was he right to leave so soon? I do not know, even now. Perhaps he could not have done otherwise. Perhaps things might have been better if he had stayed. That is for the historians to ponder, should any live for long enough to look back on these ages. All I could say with certainty is that we were to be alone again, while the forces that had come close to destroying us had not gone away. In that respect, nothing had changed. The wider Imperium would have Gilliman to protect it, driving an arc of fire across the void at the head of his Crusades armies. We on Terra only had ourselves, just as it had been since the days of legend. We had to trust and pray that it would be enough. It is important to remember, when considering all that was done then, how little we knew. It had never been easy for us, at the very heart of the Imperium, to understand what was taking place with any accuracy in its furthest reaches. No greater illustration of this exists than Cadia. That world had been the linchpin of our defences for millennia. Armies had been dispatched there from all corners of mankind's domains at regular intervals, and entire astropathic choirs were devoted to monitoring its condition. And yet, when the Despoiler finally rose up against it, we were almost entirely ignorant of what took place until the fighting was over. It is true that Cereplides, the master of the Adeptus Astra Telepathica, had given warnings long before the catastrophe occurred. It was also true that many of us had feared the worst for years ahead of the event, and had been making contingency plans for disaster. But even after that world had been lost, we could not be certain of the true position of the subsector for considerable time. Tyrion estimated that months at least had passed before the effects of the Cicatrix Maledictum, the final proof of our defeat there, reached the Sol system, wreaking its havoc across our ancient ramparts. I often think about that. We sent reinforcements there, waving the ships out of Void Dock with fanfares and music, when the world itself was already gone. By the time of Gilliman's arrival, our ignorance was greater than ever. Some of this was due to the temporary outage of the Astronomicon, which had left us unable to send ships for any distance in even partial safety. More was due to the losses we had suffered within our ranks of astropaths when the rift hit. The toll was high across all Imperial worlds, even those that clung on while the effects of the rupture washed over them, and we were no exception. By the time the worst was over, and the survivors emerged from their bunkers and semi-ruined towers to survey the wreckage, we had lost our principal means of discovering the fate of other worlds. Those few star-seers who had somehow insulated themselves against madness were heavily leaned on after that, so much so that many died from overwork. All circles in those days were vicious. The more we tried to recover ground, the more we damaged ourselves. Bit by bit, though, information reached us. Battered warships staggered into Luna's void docks, each carrying tales of destruction and mayhem. Acolytes were rushed through final training at the Obsidian Keep and pressed into service. Once the Vorlees Gate had been secured, squadrons of Mechanicus Augur ships were shot through the warp lanes, given no mission but to run hard and send back as much data as possible before being overtaken by the enemy. And, of course, by then, we had the Lord Protector himself. He had arrived on Terra at the head of a powerful army, one that had fought its way through almost unimaginable terrors all the way from distant Ultramar. They had witnessed for themselves the collapse of the Imperium's foundations, even as they had hurtled through them to reach its core. There were rumours, never confirmed, that Gilliman had even obtained access to counsel from Xenos during this time. Though, if that were true, then the abominations had disappeared long before he took up his official stewardship of the Imperium. For myself, I do not believe the whispers. He would have killed them rather than listen to their lies. Given our incomplete understanding of what lay beyond our immediate surroundings, it was inevitable that there should be disagreement over what, if anything, we could do in response to the rift opening. There were those who argued that we needed to retrench, build our strength here and guard the holy sites at the heart of our ancient empire. As Terra was still in a state of semi-revolt, riven by uprisings that could not be quelled during the days of blindness and their aftermath, those voices found much support. After all, Gilliman had brought with him unique and capable forces, including warriors from many Space Marine chapters, all of whom could have been used to repopulate the walls here and bring us back into stability. It did not take much thought, though, to see that such a policy would only postpone our demise, not prevent it. Over the millennia, Terra had grown dependent on its vast web of supplicant worlds. Thousands of them were required in order to keep our hungry mouths fed. Some losses might be sustainable among the masses if the food supplies failed for a limited time, but other functions were absolutely essential. The League of Black Ships had to maintain its perilous void circuits, lest we be starved of fuel for the newly restored Astronomicon and replacement psychers for our inter-system communication. Tithes from civilized worlds had to be collected in order to maintain the operation of government and the galactic coordination of Astra Militara movements. The volume of material that had to move in and out of the Sol system daily just to maintain a state of equilibrium was absolutely staggering. Terra had become bloated on the incoming traffic from its straggling dominions and would not survive withdrawal from their constant provision. As a result, we could not huddle behind our defences and lick our wounds. We had to strike back, and swiftly, to regain control of that which was already sliding out of our grasp forever. Gilliman had appreciated this from the start, of course, and, though I only came to realise it much later, his motivation in fighting so hard to reach the Sol system was only partially concerned with us on Terra. Of equal importance to him was Mars, where his greatest project had been ready and waiting for him, ripe to deliver him a new army of such power and scope that any previous Imperial Warmaster would have given their eyes for it. The Primaris program had been kept secret from all. For me, that, rather than their undoubted battlefield prowess, was the most remarkable thing about the entire endeavour. Tyrone had been fond of telling me that there were no secrets in the Imperium, only failures of recollection. But here was something that, if we chose to believe what we were told, had been gestating quietly for millennia, right under the noses of the High Lords and Captains General and Archmagi. Gilliman was the author of the Primaris, and so he had come here, it turned out, not to rescue us, but to activate them. I wondered sometimes whether, if the Primaris program had been instigated on a forged world of Ultramar rather than Mars, he would have made the difficult journey here at all. I like to think he would have done, and that the place of his creation meant something to him, even after the passage of so much time. I hope he would have come. Of course, we'll never know for sure. In any case, when it finally became clear, following our meeting in the Senatorum, what Gilliman was intending, I tried hard to reach Ood Udi Araskian, the Fabricator General of the Adeptus Mechanicus. I thought it important that the High Lords convene swiftly to debate this course of action, and consider how the throne world would survive once stripped of so many of its defences. I failed to make contact, despite attempting it many times. I will admit it. I also wanted to know whether Raskian had been aware of the Primaris, and if so, whether he approved of them being placed under Gilliman's sole command so quickly. But my inability to find him put pay to such ambitions. Mars being Mars, I never found out where he was, or why he remained silent. They are a strange people, made stranger by their obsessive religion, and there was a limit to what a Terran, even one as senior as I, would ever be able to uncover. But the 11 remaining High Lords were in place, some established in their roles, others new Gilliman appointees. I was the Chancellor, the one charged with running their errands, guiding them away from mistakes, and looking to their corporate welfare. The time of great upheaval was over, so we hoped, and so my duty was clear. A High Council with so many new members at a time of such great peril was always going to be difficult to manage, despite the fact it would need to be given direction swiftly before anything else could degrade or devolve. There was no choice, then, but to issue a silent prayer to the one on the throne, collect my thoughts, form a strategy, and get to work.
Chapter 2. Valerian.
It had been called the Heartspite. I'd felt its age and its malice from the moment I stepped aboard. In an instant, placing my boots on its cursed decks, I'd absorbed flashes from its long life. I had seen the wells of the eye revolving beneath it. I had seen the blurred starscapes that had once swung across it, bathing its flanks in forbidden light. That ship is gone now, destroyed by the Primarch, its tainted debris still, no doubt, orbiting the world Volise. All that history, all that long service obliterated in one heavy bombardment. It had come close, though. It had come close to giving its name some real heft. Had it succeeded, we would be hemmed in still, scratching our way to freedom like blinded felids. I think on that ship, often. My feelings towards it are complex. On the one hand, its destruction vindicated the feelings I had struggled with since being barred from the throne room. The message could not have been clearer. I was to trust in the path placed before me. I had been repulsed from service within the depths of Terra's holiest shrine, only to find the humiliation propelling me outwards, breaking the self-imposed cordon that we had laboured under for so very long. I do not think that any other warriors in the service of the Imperium could have fought for so long in that situation as we did. We had to be there, and thus the precedent was set, and we were, as an order, freed to strike against our oldest and most persistent enemy. I am not entirely immune from pride. I understand what such a victory meant to me and my brothers, as well as to my sisters in the Anathema Sykana, upon whom we relied so heavily in order to prevail both there and at the Lion's Gate. If uncertainty comes, as it so often does, I draw on the Heartspite. I recall the press of tortured iron against my bleeding palms. I recall the way the place smelled of fouled blood, and how the air within its dark chambers stung my throat. And yet, that change, like all change, brought complication with it. As a species, we have become wedded to tradition. We cling to it like a mortal child clinging to its mother, unwilling to unclasp lest we find ourselves suddenly alone and helpless. Breaking with the past, in any sense, seems like a desperate gamble. We might be wrong. We might be damning ourselves. Every step, every single step, might see us stumble, never to get up. That is what it is like to live in these times, hedged on all sides by enemies that seem to know no limit. We are faced by many weapons and suffer from many maladies, but the worst of these is doubt, which paralyzes us and makes us see danger within our own halls even before we peer outside them. To head into the darkness directly, to take the war into their hellships and cleave paths of vengeance into their agonized hearts, that releases us. We might face our death still, but that death would be a warrior's death, on our feet, looking the enemy in the eye. I would not have framed things in such a way before the Heartspite. The words themselves sound like something uttered by one of my counterparts of the Adeptus Astartes. The Space Marines have been fighting in this direct manner for far longer than we have, and we must learn from them now, I think. I am told that the Wolves of Fenris one of their more unrestrained chapters, give their warriors deed names after noteworthy engagements. I admire that practice. What I might once have thought of as a kind of wild boastfulness, I now see as something greater, a way of giving fleeting actions lasting significance, affixing the flare of a sword strike forever to its owner. Perhaps all the Space Marines, in their many different ways, understand that motivation and respond to it. So it was for that reason, I suppose, that the Primarch wished to confer his great honor on me, marking me out as linked to the engagement that allowed him to lead his crusade fleet unimpeded into the abyss. There would be no deed name from him, nothing carved in runes, but rather something a citizen of Ultramar would understand, a wreath of laurel leaves crowning me as his champion, even as the mythical generals of our ancient past were crowned. In another place, maybe that honor could have been simply accepted, taken with both hands, then left to slide unremarked into the annals. But this was Terra, a world on the edge of oblivion, where symbols mattered and allegiances were always fractured. Was I right to accept it? I believe so. Even one of my brotherhood could not easily have refused the invitation from a Primarch, and I genuinely think he intended nothing much other than gratitude. Perhaps I am wrong in that. He is famed, they say, for his political acumen. He may have been using us, just as Ravathane, I suspect, always believed. I continue to think otherwise. I continue to trust that virtue still exists among our species, and that not every gesture is double-sided. Only time will tell whether that is wise or foolish. The ceremony took place several months after the engagement at Vorlees. It took me almost that long to return to full combat readiness. The wounds I sustained on board the Heartspite were severe, and the weapons of the enemy are artfully designed to cause prolonged damage. I remember long days of semi-awareness, while drones hovered over me and attendants worked the needles and sores. I do not remember much pain, though perhaps I had already absorbed all the pain I could by then. Our relationship with our bodies as members of the Order is not entirely straightforward. We know, all of us, that we have been extensively remade from our original birth form. Much of the muscle and bone we entered the universe with is excised or altered to bring us into maturity. When we are damaged, it is most often these new structures that bear the brunt. Are we the same creation, then, as we once were? Are we even best thought of as a single organism at all? These are questions for the philosophers. The practical effect is that we can be somewhat dislocated from ourselves, even at times of extreme trauma. I received excellent care, given the privations of the time. When my broken form was returned to the Tower of Hegemon, alongside that of my brother, Ujoma, we were still struggling in the aftermath of the Lion's Gate assault. Our apothecarians were crowded places, full of desperate attempts to preserve those who might yet fight again. When I look back, I feel sure that I was marked out for special attention, no doubt for symbolic reasons, something that I am, of course, uncomfortable with. It must have seemed important to those in command that those who had broken the Liga of Terror were preserved, to be paraded thereafter as heroes of a new dawn. The same applied to my sister in service, Alea, whose whereabouts were at that point unknown to me. I later found out that she was undergoing the same frantic care elsewhere in the palace, for the same reasons. I did not dream then. Aside from a few specific exceptions, we do not dream. I did experience waking visions, though, from time to time. I saw myself back on the ship with Alea at my side, going through the combat as if for the first time. I experienced that most unexpected euphoria again, flushing down my tortured arteries and making my heart swell. I remembered that she had spoken just once before speech became impossible, and that I had laughed to hear it. Then I stirred fully. I was deep within the tower's apothecarian levels, a place of hard lumen beams and white tiles, shackled to a metal slab, my skin cut open and stuffed with wires. I could see my organs pulsing under the gauze of synth skin, and watch my vital signals track across crystal lenses mounted overhead. I observed as the chirurgeons worked on me, knowing that they were operating at the very limit of their understanding. The art of our creation is barely understood in these diminished ages, and thus the art of our preservation is also precarious. They succeeded, though. Whether by inspiration or by providence or by chance, they did enough to allow my internal systems to knit themselves back into alignment. My heart kicked back into unaided life. My lungs rose and fell. I flexed my fist and felt the sinews along my forearms wind tight. When I recovered the power of speech, my first word was Ujoma. The response was also a single word, Moritoi. That news was both welcome and unwelcome. It meant that he lived, but only within the tomb of a dreadnought. I was surprised, if I'm honest, that any suitable receptacles still existed. We had pressed so many of the scarce machines into service in the aftermath of the Lion's Gate. The fact that they had allocated one to the last survivor, beside myself, of the Vorlees expedition, reinforced the sense that they were singling us out. Did I say the last? Not quite, of course. And Tanau Alea, I asked, of the Silent Sisterhood? They did not know. It took me many days to find out that she had survived also, and had been taken into the Obsidian Keep and tended to by members of the Adeptus Astra Telepathica. Of all the news I received in that strange period between life and death, that was the most welcome. I would have grieved had her fierce spirit been taken from the universe. After that, my recovery was swift, just as it had been designed to be. I stood as soon as I was able, then walked, then started to train. My guardian spear, Gnosis, had been recovered and reconditioned, and once we were reunited, I felt something like myself again. I left the Apothecarian and re-entered a world still in ruins. I limped to the summit of the tower and looked out over a scene barred with the thin smoke of fires that refused to go out. Whole areas of the palace approaches, seen from a distance, were blackened and broken. The air smelled of ash. Further afield, out beyond the walls and into the city beyond, I could detect the rumble of ongoing conflict. I would later learn that the fighting we had engaged in at the Lion's Gate had been just the start. The palace had been secured, it was true, but across the world beyond, things had fallen apart. The release of such destructive psionic energy, coupled with the emergence into real space of the demonic, had shattered the fragile balance of control we had always striven to maintain. When the Astronomicon had blown out, more anarchy was unleashed, driven, I suspect, by the sudden withdrawal of that subconscious assurance of his presence among us. Once mania gains a grip, it is hard to shake loose. Millennia spent in privation, in fear and suspicion, had boiled over in a single instant, opening the door to darker impulses. Despite the warriors the Primarch had brought with him, Terra was a uniquely populous world, one that harbored trillions of souls. So subduing every insurrection that still raged would be a long and arduous task. I breathed in the air, filling my aching lungs, tasting the familiar aromas of the only home I had ever known. I could not hate this world. I could never hate it. But I could dislike what it had become and dream of it improving. I asked after Trajan Valoris, our Captain General, and was told that he had departed for the Ferrum Raptoris Starfort. I asked after Navradaran, my friend, and was told that he was missing. That concerned me deeply. I could discover very little about where he might have gone. I knew he had returned from his mission to gather the Anathema Psychana back to Terra, and was told that he was confirmed alive after the Lion's Gate. After that, nothing. He was of the Ephoroi, the hunters of secret things, and so his absence should not have perturbed me. But it did. In any case, the absence of those I most wished to confer with meant that my first conversation of any consequence following recovery was not with my own kind, but with the Primarch himself. He came to find me. That was another sign. I do not think he did that often. People were more accustomed to making their way to him. I was seated in my Spartan stone-walled chambers, studying the latest tactical reports from beyond the walls by candlelight. There was already talk then of putting together strike forces to seize control of strategic targets where law had broken down. We were concerned that the disorder was no longer a matter of individuals driven mad by the psychic storms, but increasingly motivated by organized, considered enemies of the Imperium. I was impatient to be doing. In my mind, our caution had been our greatest weakness for too long. I heard him approach the iron frame of the chamber's only doorway, and immediately knew who it was. I had heard the same heavy treads on board the Heartspite, hurrying to reach us before our injuries bore us down. I never saw him then. I passed out before he made it to us. But still I recognized the pattern of his gait, even out of armor and in more familiar surroundings. I stood to receive him, curious as to what had brought him to the tower. He entered. The lintels here were among the few on Terra he did not have to duck under to pass through. He was wearing white robes trimmed with ultramarine blue. His head was bare, exposing his hard-edged features, his cropped hair, the thin line of his mouth. He looked every inch the soldier, with that blunt profile that all his brothers of the Adeptus Astartes have. I was not overawed by his being before me, but still, you have to remember what he was. We had been so used to referring to them as part of ancient history, poring over both their victories and defeats, that to see him there, now, in the flesh, felt like I had entered some kind of temporal distortion. He folded his arms and regarded me for a moment. I immediately recognized what he was doing. I was doing the same thing. It was an instinct for both of us, to appraise, to gather data, assess threats, and gauge opportunities. So like us in some ways, so unlike us in others.
"Shield Captain Valerian," he said. "They told me you were recovered. I am glad to see it."
I nodded. "I owe that to you, Lord."
"And I owe the gate to you," he said, smiling slightly. "So that makes us even. When will you be ready to serve again?"
"I am ready now."
"Good."
He moved over towards the chamber's lone, narrow window, from where some of the many pinnacles of the Tower of Hegemon could be seen, rising up against a dusk sky.
"I remember meeting Constantine Valdor in this tower many times. It has barely changed."
Valdor. Our most revered name. The first Captain General, whose disappearance had never been fully explained, and which had generated endless theories and hopes, dropped casually into speech, as if he too were likely to appear out of the stonework at any moment.
"Does that disappoint you?" I asked.
He turned back to me.
"Disappoint me? No. I find it reassuring. Your kind, out of all of them, were never likely to alter. I would have been disturbed if you had."
He reached out and extended a finger against the bare wall, touching it as if he wanted reassurance it was truly the same substance as before.
"I'm constantly asked if I am disappointed. Of course, I see how things have gone, or might have gone, but then here and there I'm astonished at the strength I find."
He looked up at me.
"We told ourselves, me and my brothers, that we were the guardians of the species. Without us, the ones who endure the War Master's treachery, we believe there could be no hope for humanity. But then we were taken away, one by one, and here you all are still, stubbornly alive. That might count as the greatest surprise of all."
"The danger has never been more acute," he nodded.
"True enough. But I know those who move against us. I knew them in the Crusade Age, and I know them now. That is our hope. I remember Abaddon when he was a first captain. I remember how he was in the Great Heresy, when they came so close to destroying us. I know his mind, and I know what drives him. Is that enough to stop him? I do not know. But at least we have something."
I realized why he had come then.
"You will not stay on Terra," I said. "I cannot. My people are defenseless out there."
"My people?"
"Take me with you," I said.
He looked briefly startled.
"See, you are still capable of surprises," he said, amused. "But I would not presume to command you. That is for your Captain General. He wishes you to remain on Terra, to join the pacification effort. I agree with him. Terra must look to its own guardians now."
I had surprised myself. I still do not know where the words had come from. Perhaps I was still under the influence of my injuries, but it put me on the back foot.
"The war is not on Terra," I said. "The war is everywhere," he said. "You know this."
I began to wonder why he had come. Members of my order had already taken ship as part of the coming muster to retake lost territory. If Orlise had taught me anything, it was that the old conservatism over our deployment had reached its end. Perhaps, though, this was not about our being exceptional at all. Perhaps this was about our limitations. He looked directly at me. His expression was human, more human than mine could ever have been.
"See, I wished only to thank you," he said, "to honor you, as we honor those on Ultramar. You are free to refuse, but I have learned that symbols are important. I have in mind a ceremony, something to give this world ambition, to bind it together. You will need that unity in the days to come, whether or not I succeed in the void."
That was it. So simply expressed, a mere trifle, a slight gesture. Who could refuse it? Even then, my heart spoke against it. He was a Primarch, though. The possibility of renewal was bound up with him more than anything that had occurred in the past 1,000 years. "Tell me more," I said.
Chapter 3. Alaya. I did not expect to return from Vorlees. In truth, it would have been altogether acceptable if I had not. Vengeance would have been served. Valerian might have been insufferable, but he was deadly. And together with him, his brothers and my sisters, we more than extracted fair recompense for what had been done to my old homeworld. When I awoke again then, much later, back on Terra, it came as something of a surprise. For some time afterwards, I had no idea where I was or what had happened. A medical orderly tried to take my blood at one point. I seized her and pinned her to the wall, scattering the vein lines, thinking she was somehow part of the nightmares that still ran through my waking mind. It took the facility's security detail to prise her free and get me back onto the cot, a significant number of them, I am not ashamed to say. After that, it all came back, slowly. I remembered our desperate run to Terra, in a ship that was coming apart even as we outpaced the rift's surge. Then the demons before the gate, the Shaitane, the knights in grey. And then, last of all, the black legionnaires on that iron-dark ship, lumbering towards us through the gloom, as desperate to slay us as we were to spend our fury on them. So for all that, I was alive. My vow of silence had been broken in the heat of the fight, but only one soul still living had heard that. And I had no need to worry over whether he would tell anyone. Did I even need to keep it now, when so much else had been changed? I decided to hold on to it, for the time being at least. Some things, some decisions become a part of you, like a limb, even if they are damaged. I had lost the blade I took onto that ship. I still have the vaguest memory of it being shattered, breaking open in a whirl of flame-edged pieces. Only sorcery could have done that, despite the difficulty that sorcery has in finding a way to harm me. They must have been getting desperate. I enjoy thinking of them like that. Once I began to recover myself, I wondered what came next. I knew that the Silent Sisterhood had been recalled prior to the rift reaching Terra. I did not know how complete that recall was. Perhaps all living members of my sisterhood had been found and recovered. I think it more likely that many were missed, and are now dead, or languish still far from help. So much else remained unclear to me. Why had we been called back just then? The Imperium could have benefited from our loyal service generations ago, and had never chosen to seek us out. More pressing, to my mind at least, was the fact no one had ever given me a good reason for our long decay in isolation. At first I suspected that the adepts I spoke to were being evasive. Later I realized the truth. They had no idea either. I was like a revenant to them, a spectre of a forgotten age. The throne world was a planet of scholars who liked to put things in their proper place, and I had no place at all, proper or otherwise. I thought that perhaps we would be discarded again. Despite the fact that so many of us had already died in the frenetic sequence of events following our rediscovery, I thought it at least likely that some council edict or regulation would see us dispatched to the void, an embarrassing reminder of an Imperium that should have died a long time ago. I was wrong about that, at least to begin with. The High Lords, they told me, were no longer governing the Imperium. A scandalized member of the Adeptus Astra Telepathica told me so, her eyes wide with a kind of outraged pleasure. Rumours ran through the entire Senatorum and beyond concerning Gilliman, who was, so they all said, working his way through the echelons of power like a grox through a fodder warehouse. Everything was changing. Everything would be better. The corruption would disappear. The victories would start to roll in. Humanity. So stupid. So weak. They would cling on to anything at all, rather than look themselves in the eye and try to be honest about how they had failed. Gilliman was an individual. A tall one, no doubt, with an impressive sword, but one just the same. He could be ended by a stray vortex grenade, or a Titan's payload, or a lone warp core breach, and then we would be back to where we were before. Only weakened by that delusive old scoundrel, Hope. At least, that is what I thought then. I would like to think the same now, but I can't. Not quite. Not since I met him. I was still under the care of the Medicaid teams, although they were already heartily sick of me, and I of them. In a few days they would be transferring me to a forward assault detachment, and I would be glad to see the back of the world that had given me nothing but disappointment since I had arrived. I could see a path opening up for me, a way to serve, and I began to contemplate going to war again. Then he arrived, in my chamber, unannounced, without an escort, dressed in simple robes and carrying no visible weapon. I must have stared at him, stupidly, for too long.
"Forgive me, sister,"
he said, bowing.
"I have so little time, and they burden me with so many pressing things. But I had to take the opportunity while I was here. They told me you were returned to health."
What does a baseline human see when they see a Primarch? I do not know. Perhaps they perceive the warp flowing through their veins. Perhaps they are dazzled by that. Maybe they are shocked into silence. I saw an old, old man. It didn't matter that his body was perfect, and that he carried himself with the balanced poise of a space marine, or that his eyes burned with a cold and clear light. He was ancient. His skin might have been stone. He was cast out of time, a relic spun from its prescribed orbit and sent hurtling into the unwelcoming present. Stripped of soul fire, he resembled an old furnace, once booming with flame, now dark and echoing. If I had been alive in his own time, perhaps I would have had the same impression as I did just then. Or maybe the long eons had changed him, stripping out that which once made him vital, and leaving only the ossified shell, the thing that made him so physically strong. But he had something, I'll give him that. It was hard to look him in the eye. You could not have laughed at him. "I am almost there," I signed, inclining my head respectfully.